A1.
Number 5A.
Now, yesterday we were considering the third side of the Holy City, namely Christianity. And when one considers Christianity, one really is investigating the nature of man. And at the end of last lesson, we were considering the great distinction which has to be made between God's man as the idea of God and the Adam man as the mortal concept of man. And we could see that only that can be called man which is God's creation, therefore which is the creation of mind and of spirit and of soul and of principle and of life and truth and love. Only that which can be deduced from God, or the seven synonymous terms, can be defined as man, as the true man. In distinction to this concept of man, we have the false concept of man, which we call mortals, or a mortal, the Adam man. That concept of a man, which is really the counterfeit of this true man. Mrs. Eddy says, mortals are the counterfeit of immortals. They are not the counterfact of immortals. That's a great difference. A mortal is not a fact. It's not something that exists and has an enduring identity. It is a counterfeit. It just takes the true fact about man as the idea of God and tries to reverse it. So, mortal man is only what Mrs. Eddy would call a burlesque of God's man. He is never man. So I feel that the greatest lie that has ever been made and told was when that creation, which is called Adam, has been named man. And from that misunderstanding arises really all the trouble we have. Because we consider that as man, which is the counterfeit of God's man, we are devoting and worshipping really a concept of man which is only a counterfeit and not a fact in being. So let's see what this true idea man in its perfection is. Let's see that man is really only that which God knows. Or if I turn the sentence around, it's perhaps even clearer. God knows only his own ideas, and that is called man. So God knows man only as idea. That's the starting point from which we should go out always when we want to know anything about the true man. That we go out from God and begin to see that only that which God himself knows, that only that has the right to the term man. So, because God is always complete and perfect, we can see that God's man is always perfect and will always be perfect. So that we can further see that the true man has never lost its perfection, the standard of perfection, and therefore never has to regain perfection. Man was always perfect, is perfect, and ever will be perfect. You see, if man is God's creation, then we could reason like this. If man could fall away from his perfection, then God would have first to fall away from his own perfection. Only if God could lose his perfection, man, which is God's idea, could lose his perfection. But as the divine principle is always the divine principle and remains the divine principle and can never lose its own perfection, therefore also the idea of that divine principle, namely man, can actually never lose his perfection. Now this is a very great and important starting point for any metaphysical practice and healing. So man, as the idea of God, immortal man, has really nothing at all in common with mortal man. There is no point where mortal man meets immortal man. No point where the concept of immortal man could mingle with mortal man. Jesus would say that very plainly. He would say, "For the prince of this world cometh and hath nothing in me." See, the concept of the immortal, the concept of mortality and mortal man just has no abiding place within the true concept of man. Therefore, Jesus could say, when he was speaking of himself, he could say, "I have overcome the world." He could also have said, "I have overcome the concept of mortal manhood." So, another consequence which we can draw from this is that man could never sin and can never sin. That man, the true idea man, cannot do wrong and therefore can never be penalized. If man cannot sin, he cannot neither be penalized. At the end of all the epistles is a very nice verse in the Epistle of Jude, where Jude makes the following statement. He says, "Now unto him that is able to keep you from falling." You see, God is able to keep man from falling. He just can't let man go. Principle just can't let his idea go. "Now unto him that is able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy, to the only wise God, our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and forever." See, he could see that man is kept from falling by God, and that he is presented before the presence of God faultless, and that he can never lose this perfect status of manhood. So let us just keep that always nicely in mind, never to forget it, that man is only the idea of God. Therefore, man cannot fall away from his perfection. Man cannot lose, actually, his divine manhood. Mrs. Eddy would say that like this, she says, man is incapable of sin, sickness, and death. He's just incapable of sin, sickness, and death. The real man, she says, cannot depart from holiness. Nor can God, by whom man is evolved, engender the capacity or freedom to sin. So, because God, who is whole and holy, can never create in man an ability or a capacity or the faculty to sin, to become sick, or to die. Man is just incapable of sin, sickness, and death. Now, having shown the nature of really immortal manhood, let us consider, therefore, the counterfeit of such an immortal, namely a mortal. What then is a mortal? Well, we must see that the mortal is not a fallen immortal, that the mortal was not once immortal and perfect and has lost his perfection. Mortals just were never perfect. Mrs. Eddy would state it like this. She says, mortals are not fallen children of God. They never had a perfect state of being, which may subsequently be regained. So let's speak very clear about this, that what we call a mortal, a sinning, sick, dying, fallen mortal, that he was never perfect, and that that mortal can never regain perfection. You know so well that the general feeling is that we would like to make out of a mortal an immortal, that we would like to make mortals more perfect, that we would like to improve the mortal until he is perfect. Now, this is not logical. The something which is imperfect can never become perfect. Imperfection is, by definition, imperfect. You would agree with me very easily, say, that we can never make out of darkness light. You would consider this absurd, that you can have darkness and then you make out of it light. Or that you have an error and make it true. We would never think of that. And in the same vein, really, we should never think that we can make out of matter spirit. And therefore, we can never make out of a mortal an immortal. This is just an attempt which will fail. You see, Mrs. Eddy tried to explain this in the textbook like this. She said, the condemnation of mortals to till the ground. See, Adam was condemned to till the ground. And she says, the condemnation of mortals to till the ground means this. And now she defines what this condemnation is. Namely, that mortals should so improve material belief by thought tending spiritually upward as to destroy materiality. Well, You will see, in talking with most Christian scientists who are not enlightened enough, that this is the very thing they try to do. They try to improve the material belief by thought tending spiritually upward, and in this way try what Mrs. Eddy calls to destroy materiality. So this is a very widely known belief, and Mrs. Eddy calls this attempt to improve mortality to the point where it becomes immortal, she says, this attempt is really the condemnation of mortals. It isn't the blessing. It's just the opposite. That's just the condemnation. That's the condemnation that is on human consciousness, that we try to improve that which is imperfect, so as to make that which is imperfect more and more perfect. And this is really the curse on Adam. This isn't the blessing. What is the answer? Mrs. Eddy goes on in that paragraph and says, man, created by God, was given dominion over the earth. She shows, really, that we should never try to go out from imperfection and then by uplifting thought climb up to perfection. That the starting point we have to take in consciousness is always man's primeval perfection. We always start out right with the truth of being and see that the truth of being has dominion over every error and destroys error. Now, you see, this sounds sometimes a bit strange, and yet, in every other walk of life, we are obedient to this divine method. If you have made a wrong calculation, which have perhaps taken you a whole page, and you come at the end and you see somewhere you have gone wrong, the result is wrong. Well, what are we doing? Do we try then to improve this calculation? Or are we not doing something which is scientific, namely to start again right away from perfection, reasoning again right away from the divine principle of mathematics, and reason quite anew and try to see the truth, always the truth, always the perfect rule, always the perfect law, and that perfect law will uncover the error which we have made in calculating and therefore destroy the false result. So in mathematics too, we really use the right method of always going out from the divine principle, from the perfect law and the perfect rule and the perfect system, and let that have dominion over its counterfeit. And so in the same way, really, we should use our knowledge and our understanding when it concerns our being, our manhood. So, just think over that paragraph which I have read about the condemnation of mortals to till the ground. It's one of the most important paragraphs, I think, in regard to the question of mortals and immortals. It's on page 545, line 7, that whole paragraph. And just study it over and over and over again, until you see the light, until we are no more tempted to improve a mortal, to start out with imperfection and try to improve imperfection. Man is perfect, was perfect, and ever will be perfect. That's the only starting point. Now, let us tackle another question in regard to man. So often we will find in the textbook a statement which says that man is the reflection of God, and uses this term reflection quite a bit. Mrs. Eddy would say man is and forever has been God's reflection. You see again a statement that man never has fallen away from God, forever has been what? God's reflection. What does this term reflection as a symbol mean? See, reflection is really that which the Bible illustrates as image and likeness. Image and likeness, taken together in one term, means reflection. It is not just an image. It is an image which is like the original. It's an image which is exactly the same as the original. It's image and likeness. Now, let me try to symbolize what this means. Let's take the illustration of a mirror. You have always an object before the mirror, then the mirror, and in the mirror, really, there is the reflection. You see the image of the object before the mirror. So, for our sake at the present moment, we can distinguish three things. The object, then the mirror, and then the reflection which is brought out through the mirror. If we use this as an illustration for illustrating divine metaphysics, it means that the object before the mirror is really God, the divine principle. Let's say that this object which now is mirrored forth, can you say mirrored forth? Yes? Yes? Fine. I thought I had invented something.
No.
So you have the object, God, then the mirror, and then that which is mirrored forth, the image and likeness. Now, in our simile, what would be the mirror? The mirror is that which establishes the coincidence between the object and the reflection. The mirror has that office to really make the object before the mirror and the reflection in the mirror one in quality. So the mirror, therefore, would be the Christ, because we have seen in the definition of the Christ that Christ means the spiritual agreement between God and man, or the divine coincidence between God and man. So that which makes really principle and idea to coincide is the Christ. Well, that's the office of a mirror, and so we could call the mirror Christ, the Christ. So we have first the object before the mirror, God, then the mirror as the Christ consciousness, and then we have the outcome of the divine principle of the Christ idea, namely the reflection. man and the universe. Though the image and likeness, the reflection which appears, is really man. So we have God, then Christ, and then man. The Word, Christ, Christianity. But let us see something about this mirror. You know that the mirror must be very even, smooth. And only if the mirror is very even and smooth, the picture in the mirror is really a likeness of the object. If the mirror is not smooth, then you know that what appears in the mirror is not a likeness of the object, but is a deflection and not a reflection. So we can see that we only get the true concept of man as the image and likeness of God if that Christ is absolutely pure, is absolutely scientific. You see, therefore, that the mirror, in which is the Christ, in order to bring forth a true concept of man as the image and likeness of God, that Christ must be really Christ science, that the mirror must be really the Christ science, the divine science, because only when in our consciousness we understand God. See, the scientific sense comes in when we understand God. Only then is our unity, our spiritual agreement with God perfect, completely whole, without any fault in it, without any flaw in it. See? So really, this mirror is the important thing. If the mirror, if our consciousness is not scientific, if our Christ unity with God is not scientific, is not properly understood, then something is reflected in our consciousness which is an image but not a likeness. It's an image, but a deflection, a false image, a deflection, and that we would call a mortal. So it all depends on that Christ consciousness, if in the mirror appears a mortal or an immortal. Now, what are the consequences of this illustration? One of the consequences is that we should always remember that what the object before the mirror does, the picture, the image in the mirror does also. Therefore, that the causative power and motion is always with the object and never with the reflection, which means that all the action that is ever going on is God, and that man as the reflection of God cannot do anything else but just do exactly what God does. Or in other words, we can see that there is nothing original about man, that all the origin is in God, that man can do nothing out of himself. That's the great point. That man just can't do anything out of himself. He can only do that which the object, God, does. Jesus would say this like this, he would say, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he sees the Father do. For what things soever he does, these also does the Son likewise. Here in this verse in John, you get a very wonderful, clear illustration and explication of reflection. That the Son just can't do anything else but what he sees the Father do. Which means that in our practical life, it would be in vain to change man before we change our understanding of God. We must start with God. And only in the measure as we have a higher concept of God, the Word, and in the measure as we submit ourselves unrestrictedly and willingly to this Word of God, that's the Christ, that's the pure mirror, only in that way we show forth, we mirror forth the true sense of man. So man really cannot improve himself. That's the condemnation of mortals to till the ground. This false sense, which is so, what is the word, prevalent in religious thinking, and especially in ethics, that man should improve himself, out of himself. This is really the curse which was on Adam. It is nothing holy about it. It's nothing good about it. The only thing we can do with a mortal is to let him disappear and not to improve him. The only thing we can do with a mortal is to turn away from the mortal and to turn to the Word of God, to God, to unite in the Christ consciousness with that God. Then we have the power of God within us. And with that power of God, we bring forth the true idea of God, that's man. And then when we bring forth the true idea of man, the false concept of man has no more room within us and is gone. So, from this illustration of the mirror, we can see that really man is only that which is mirrored forth by God and the mirror, by the Christ. That man is not a person, a body, but is only that which God manifests. And when you read that nice, clear exposition in the Christian Science textbook, in the chapter Recapitulation, where Mrs. Eddy asks the question, what is man? Then she answers that question in the first paragraph in a very impersonal way. She doesn't answer that question, what is man, by saying he is this and that and so on, but answers it by saying that man is that which, not he who. See, man is not a person, is not a human being. Man is the idea of love, the idea of God, is therefore a that which, and not the he who. So she would say, man is that which has no separate mind from God. You see again the unity between God and man. She says, man is that which has not a single quality underived from deity. See how she would here indicate that man is all that which we can derive, deduce, so to say, from deity, from our understanding of God as mind and spirit and soul and principle and life and truth and love. That which is derived from that, so that we can say, that's man. Or she says, man is that which possesses no life, intelligence, nor creative power of his own. See again that illustration of the mirror, that the picture in the mirror has nothing of his own. But, she goes on and says, but reflects spiritually all that belongs to his maker. That is man, that which is derived from God, that which belongs to God. Only to that, really, we can give the name man. Or as Mr. Dawley would say, that man is a term we have applied to God's consciousness of himself. See, if you take God's consciousness of himself, God knowing himself, God reflecting on himself, God thinking about himself, so God never thinks, but we use that terminology just to express God being conscious about himself. That state of mind we can call man. To that whole concept we can give the name man. You see how very different this definition of man is than to consider Adam, which has been taken out of the ground and breathed into and breathed some life in his nostrils. That's the mortal.